I'm Peggy Waymire with the World Vision Report. This week, greetings from Israel, land of checkpoints, stalled peace talks, and good hummus.
Everything in this country is bad. I'm staying here for the hummus. If I didn't have hummus, I wouldn't be here. Hummus and my wife keep me going.
Meanwhile, here in the States, what we do to our hummus is almost heretical.
I have here, let's see, we got Tuscan hummus, cilantro and jalapeno, roasted red pepper, zesty lemon, black bean, artichoke spinach hummus. My Israeli neighbors would say, you guys are crazy, you don't know what hummus is.
And the music of Enric Sifa, a young Rwandan who lost his family in the genocide. Now, he's one of his country's biggest stars. Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with President Obama at the White House a few days ago. They discussed the state of the Middle East peace talks. There's been little progress on that front, but that hasn't stopped the city of Nablus from forging ahead. It's the largest city in the West Bank, and almost two-thirds of its residents live below the poverty line. But the economy in Nablus is rebounding. Linda Gradstein reports.
5 months ago, 25-year-old Shireen Abdu opened a new bridal shop called La Dana. With its white bead-encrusted gowns and expensive silk dresses, the shop would be at home anywhere in Europe or the U.S. But this is Nablus, and where, until recently, unemployment was close to 50%. Abdu says her business is going even better than she had hoped.
This summer was great. If we think about other summers, you know, it's much better, because now they can come from outside Nablus, from the checkpoints and this stuff. They can come inside Nablus. It's much better.
Nablus, a city of almost 200,000 Palestinians, is opening up. Israel recently dismantled a large checkpoint a few miles north of the city and another one just outside Nablus. It used to take hours waiting on long lines to cross those checkpoints. Now cars whiz through both ways with Israeli soldiers waving them through. Abdu says the city feels more open.
Nablus was closed from everywhere, so you cannot get out, you cannot get into Nablus. So the economy inside Nablus was for people inside Nablus only. So it was really, really bad.
Now, for the first time in many years, Israel is permitting Arab citizens of Israel to come to Nablus on Saturdays. Every weekend, dozens of buses loaded with bargain hunters come to Nablus, where prices are cheaper than in Israel. The moves are part of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's efforts to promote what he calls economic peace. The idea is that improving Palestinians' lives can pave the way for an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal at some point in the future. That's also the goal of a U.S.-funded program to train Palestinian police in Jordan. Hundreds of those police have been deployed in Nablus. They're working to stop terror attacks on Israel, and they've imposed law and order here. As a result, crime in Nablus is way down. And, as Nablus Mayor Adli Yaish explains, there have been other improvements as well.
When I make my people better life, of course, I'm more happy, especially for children. Actually, also as municipality, we have done many places for children to go through. This month, we opened three places for parks. As a mayor, things that half of our population children, they were under siege. Most of them never been out of Nablus. They are under stress, so they are always under stress. We try to reduce their stresses.
He doesn't like that. Not one bit.
On a recent afternoon, Batman the Dark Knight was showing at a new movie theater. Until this one opened a few months ago, Nablus hadn't had a cinema in 20 years. The theater wasn't very crowded. Most people prefer Arabic language films rather than reading subtitles, says Bashir Shaka, the manager of the theater.
It's something new in the city. This is the most important thing. It's a step ahead for people in Nablus. Most of them, they're enjoying it. It's a good start.
And that's what many residents here are saying about the city itself. For the World Vision Report, I'm Linda Gradstein in Nablus.
There's another war in the Middle East, one you don't hear about over here, the war over hummus. Israelis and Lebanese both claim the popular Middle Eastern dip as their own. Just last month, 300 Lebanese chefs got together and made the largest dish of hummus ever. At 4,500 pounds, it made it into the Guinness Book of Records. The Lebanese admit it was a way of telling Israel to keep its hands off the hummus. But that's unlikely to happen. We asked reporter Daniel Estrin, who's based in Jerusalem, to find out how the pros there make their favorite dish. And in the process, Daniel stumbled upon yet another Middle Eastern minefield.
I'm a sucker for Mohammed's hummus. His hole-in-the-wall eatery is right across from the walls of Jerusalem's old city. Mohammed and I have become friendly over the years, which is why I was startled when he turned down my request for a little cooking demonstration for the story. I don't want to reveal my recipe, he said, but try talking to my friend down the street. He pointed me in the direction of another famous hummus joint. There, the hummus man looked at me from behind the counter and apologized. My recipe is a secret, he said. So I called Abu Shukri. People here swear that his is the best hummus in the country. I arrived one afternoon to Abu Shukri's restaurant. It's in an Arab village just outside of Jerusalem. That's me talking to Abu Shukri's son, Baha. He's on his way. He'll be here soon, Baha promised. In the meantime, why don't you have some hummus? I wiped clean a bowl of it with some pita bread, and I noticed some framed newspaper articles adorning the walls, like plaques marking an historical site. And this is an historical site. It's the battlefield of Israel's Great Hummus War. The story goes like this. There are two cousins in the village who claim to be the legendary Abu Shukri. Their first names are Sami and Subhi. Sami married Subhi's sister. Subhi married Sami's sister. Are you with me? The point is, they ran a tiny little hummus joint together for 17 years. But the cousins quarreled and split. Each opened his own hummus joint, one right across the street from the other. And each called himself Abu Shukri.
And there was conflict and, you know, and even, yes, everybody know this story about two Abu Shukri and it was in the TV and it's big noise.
Mudi Abdul Rahman is a member of the family. While I was waiting for Abu Shukri number one to arrive, I headed over to Abu Shukri restaurant number two to get its side of the story.
You're the original?
Yes.
What is the secret to your hummus?
The secret? The hand. Who make the hummus, this is the secret.
Could I see how you make it?
Yes, I don't have any problem, but yes. No, Abu Shukri will make it. He's not here now. When he come, I think he will be happy. He show everyone how to make the hummus.
While I waited, Moody insisted that I have a bowl of hummus. I didn't tell him that I was full from eating at the rival hummus joint, so I ate. And as the time passed, I realized that Abu Shukri number two wasn't showing up anytime soon. So, back to Abu Shukri restaurant number one. While I waited for guru number one to arrive, I asked a couple of satisfied-looking customers why they enjoy hummus.
We need it like as an injection. I had hummus last week somewhere else, and it's like, why did I even go there?
Everything in this country is bad. I'm staying here for the hummus. If I didn't have hummus, I wouldn't be here. Hummus and my wife keep me going.
Hummus, like most things here, is political. You may have seen this clip from the mockumentary Bruno about a reckless, awkward fashion journalist. Bruno goes to the Middle East and conducts this joint interview with a real former Mossad agent and a real Palestinian academic.
Why are you so anti-Hamas? I mean, isn't pita bread the real enemy?
You're confusing Hamas with hummus, I believe. Hummus has nothing to do with
Hamas. Do you think there is a relation between Hamas and hummus? So was the founder of Hamas a chef?
Okay, so at this point, I'd been waiting a few hours for Sami, hummus guru number one, to show up. Sammy's son, Baha, looks at me. We both know that Sammy isn't coming. But I wasn't about to leave without doing some investigative reporting. Finally, Baha sighed, smiled, and took me behind the counter. And this is what I saw. A pot of steaming chickpeas, a jar of tahini sauce, some cold water, a pinch of spices. Baha threw it all into the grinding machine. And voila! But how did he do it? Baha's demonstration was so quick, I was bedazzled and confused. And I realized one thing. A good hummus maker is like a magician. If he reveals the secret, there'd be no magic. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin in the village of Abu Ghosh, Israel.
And there's a very funny Israeli ad for hummus on our website. Check it out on worldvisionreport.org. Reporter Daniel Estrin just happens to be in Minneapolis right now, where he continues his quest to find the perfect hummus. So Daniel, we find you now in a U.S. grocery store. Where are you standing?
That's right. I'm in the deli section of a supermarket here in Minneapolis. And I see a large selection of hummus. I have here, let's see, we got Tuscan hummus, cilantro and jalapeno, roasted red pepper, zesty lemon, black bean, artichoke spinach hummus.
Would you see all these selections in Israel?
I would never see this kind of selection in an Israeli supermarket, in an Arab supermarket, anywhere in the Middle East. I mean, Israelis and Palestinians are definitely purists when it comes to their hummus. They like it creamy. They like it with a lot of tahini sauce. I even saw a hummus the other day at Trader Joe's that said, "Hummus without tahini," proudly displayed. Well, that would really make some Israelis and Palestinians completely horrified.
I gotta tell you, I pronounce it hummus, you do. My neighbors pronounce it hummus and insist that that's the right pronunciation. How many different ways are there to say this?
Oh gosh, there's hummus and hummus and I've heard every which way pronounced in America. One time I heard it humus. In Israel, Israelis say hummus. Arab pronunciation, the Arabic pronunciation is hummus. So, you know, it all tastes the same.
Hey, Daniel, before we let you leave that grocery store, I'm wondering, what's top of the pops right now in Israel where you live?
Well, there is a really, really popular band called Balkan Beatbox. They're really awesome. They have really interesting kind of world beat. They sing in a variety of different languages. And the most popular song right now is a kind of a mix of English and Hebrew.
I think we're going to go out on that, so I'll say goodbye, and thanks so much for strolling through the grocery store with us.
My pleasure. Bon appetit.
Ahead, 6 months in Sudan, a doctor's story. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire, and this is the World Vision Report. Who knows how many doctors and nurses were inspired by the TV show MASH?
What happened to her? Somebody dropped a bomb in her village from an airplane.
Who did it?
He just dropped it. He didn't autograph it.
No, I mean, was it one of theirs or one of ours?
What difference does that make?
A lot. It makes a lot of difference.
Not to her.
That was a clip from the TV show MASH. Because of that program, James Moskalik was inspired to join Doctors Without Borders and to go to Sudan. But he wasn't prepared for what he found at the makeshift hospital in Abyei. Moskalik was just one of two doctors in the remote outpost, and he had an endless supply of patients, but a short supply of anything to treat them with. He says he worked through his troubled feelings in the evenings by writing a blog. It became widely read, and now his blog is a book called 6 Months in Sudan. We're going to talk with him about his time in Sudan. But first, here's James Moskalik reading about a typical day in the hospital.
Today when I was doing rounds and I was figuring out what to do with a young boy who developed a fever after a run with measles, a boy in whom I had already stuck a chest tube and 3 needles to try and drain a large collection of bacteria. As I was deciding whether to stick more things into his chest or send him to another hospital or if he was going to die, and heard from my translator that this boy, already ghostly, had refused food that morning, I looked down, and beneath his bed was a butterfly, struggling to right itself from the floor, but instead spinning in circles, 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 its wings tracing round grooves in the dust. Today a baby died about 10 minutes after coming into the hospital. She was dirty and covered in grass. The family came from far away and asked if I knew somewhere nearby where they could bury her. I said I did not. They thanked me and left. When people I see in the hospital are asked where they are from, they answer in days. 3 days away, some say. I admitted a girl from 2 days away. Her mother had died in the hospital 2 months before, and she was her only child. Her father was a soldier with other wives. A neighbor found her lying on the ground and hitchhiked to Abyei to deliver her to our door, an orphan. She was so severely dehydrated that when I listened to her heart, she tried to suck in my stethoscope. Today she is better. She gained a kilogram in 24 hours, from 5 to 6. The man who brought her said he can't stay, doesn't know her relatives. Her problems are mine now. There's a little boy here who the staff is so fond of that I think they're delaying discharging him because they would miss him too much. He's always between your legs and crawling onto your lap. If it comes to me, I'm never discharging him either.
I'm wondering if you could set the scene for us there, what this town or village was like where you were working and who the patients were.
You know, the town of Abyei was, tried to imagine it so many times before I arrived, and only when I glimpsed it as the plane descended over the, you know, the flatness of the Sudan desert did I catch a quick glimpse of it. And the second it was gone, you know, these flash of half-built huts flew into view, and then all of a sudden we're skimming across the desert again. And what the town was, it was being built again after so many years of war. And so people were returning in the hopes that peace would last. They would be able to build a home. And they were trying with some, you know, help from us in the hospital to make this a home again. It was for many of them. And their hopes were high for the future.
You talk about feeling pretty powerless sometimes with the severity of the problems that came in. And it was just you and a nurse and a Sudanese young doctor. Did you feel like you could really make a difference, or was it a constant frustration and sadness for you?
Well, I wrote those scenes in the book about feeling overwhelmed with the immensity of the task presented with you every day because I wanted it to be honest. But when people ask me if I made a difference, I know that I did because I can remember that one kid who came into the hospital. He was 3 years old. He'd never walked in his whole life. And after I started him on TB treatment, he stood for the very first time after 2 weeks. And it may not have meant much to the world, but it meant the world to that kid. I think, you know, in the end, as I write in the book, at some point you have to realize if you choose to do this work, it can't be about you. If it's just about you, then you're going to lose your motivation at some point because you're going to be taught a lot of hard lessons, I think. That it's ultimately, you're supposed to be doing this because at some level, as naive as that hope may be, you think it's the right thing to be doing.
And is that why you chose to join Doctors Without Borders? I mean, was that your motivation for doing this work?
Well, I think I've been asked the question enough time that I've really given it a good thought. And I think at some level, the real reason why I do this kind of work is because of MASH, the TV show MASH. I think I watched it for 15 formative years of my life. And it seemed like I created the very MASH life existence for myself. But, you know, that's the pat answer. But the real one is, you know, it's to really be on the ground in the trenches doing the work rather than proselytizing from a distance. And the truth is, if people believe there's some responsibility for us to have for patients who suffer in places like Sudan, then that falls to people like myself who are doctors, who have the capacity to solve some of the medical problems there. To whom else would it fall? So I think if you see it, there's some responsibility.
Mm. So it sounds like you thought through this very well before you went. And I'm wondering if there were any big surprises or if once you got on the ground and were there for a few months, if it was really what you had prepared for and anticipated living in Sudan as a doctor.
So it was harder than I anticipated it was going to be, partly because there was very little opportunity to retreat, or I didn't create it. You know, I took it very seriously, my medical responsibilities, maybe a little bit too much. But, you know, it was my first real intense mission like this. And I also took it seriously, the writing, the blog. People started to respond to it. And I thought, well, I have this great chance to tell a story, to connect people. People are connecting to this little tiny place that no one cares about, no one had ever even heard about. And maybe, you know, what is true of city streets, what makes them safe is the number of eyes on them. And if you get eyes on this little place in Abyei, then maybe some attention would happen before, you know, it got burned down to the ground.
James, when you look back over your 6 months in Sudan, is there any specific event or something about being there that stuck with you the most or changed you most as a doctor?
I remember one of the clinical times. I was a young woman came in and she was very sick and she had retained products of conception, meaning the placenta was still inside and her baby was fine and she wasn't. And despite my best attempts, she died very quickly after coming into the hospital. And the intensity of that experience, all of us trying to save this woman, is one that I think is the clearest in my memory, that emotion. I can remember the hope that no one would look me in the eye, you know, after we bent down to clean up the room and covered the woman's body and someone was cleaning the blood from her arm, or we tried to get an IV but couldn't. And I was just like, I just don't, I hope no one looks me in the eye. Mm. You just make it too real. You know, I just want to go. So I think, you know, there's many of those encounters, but that is the one that I think that had the very profound effect on me as a person.
Mm-hmm. Is this the woman whose husband was the security guard at the hospital?
Right. Yes, yes, it was. Yeah, I found out later.
So you knew her husband.
Recognized. Well, I didn't recognize him at the time. I didn't recognize him until I saw him 3 weeks later. But I instantly recognized him, you know, from that night. I asked myself that question, you know, as I'm recounting it again. Are you sure you didn't recognize him? Are you sure? Or were you just wanting to close off so much that you didn't want anything else to be added to that situation? You just wanted to go home. The last thing you want to do is be helping this guy when he asks you if he could, you could help him get his wife's body to the graveyard. The last thing you wanted to be doing was helping him put her into a truck.
He asked you for
and
that.
He did, yeah. He said it was a common request, if we can help take people who died to be buried outside of town. And we never did. It was a policy not to, just because, you know, we can't be a hearse and we can't be an ambulance. You know, we can barely be a hospital most of the time,
right.
And we're trying our best to be that. And it seemed like, I think it was frustrating. It was frustrating for us. Maybe it was nice to have boundaries so we could, you know, shut that door. I don't know if it's a good idea to close it or not. But it was frustrating, I think, because a lot of the time our limitations seemed like refusals, like we wouldn't, when the truth was often we just couldn't.
Mm. You also write about a little boy who had cut the end of his finger off and he came in with his dad and you sewed it up. And then he and his dad would come back regularly and you would just put clean gauze on it. That seems like a very normal, minor case, but you seemed to get a lot of joy out of something that simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was such a reliable piece of kindness in my day that I kept them coming back long after that thing had healed. I think we all knew it, but me and the dad started to get along a little bit, and he spoke a bit of English, so he would come back and was very proud that he could cut the queue and come, and I would take them aside and see how his son was doing and whether he was going to school and things like that.
And you knew this boy wasn't going to die from a cut finger. I mean,
yeah,
you could
exactly.
Trust that he would be there and he could look at you and smile and
right.
and you could feel good about it when he walked away.
There's no way. That was the best cared for finger, I think, in the whole country, I'm sure.
The best cared for finger.
Yeah.
You write, James, about a young girl throughout the book that you became very attached to. Can you tell us a little about her?
Yeah. Shortly after I arrived to Sudan, I was on call and a neighbor brought in a girl who'd been abandoned. She was an orphan. Her mother had died in the hospital earlier of meningitis. And this neighbor brought this girl in because she was starving and thirsty. And so this young girl, she's about 9 months old, her problems became mine. But there was something about her. And I can't say that she was cuter or brighter or I don't know, but I started to fall in love with her. And it was, I think, because she seemed heartbroken. And so I became very attached to her very quickly. You know, she was still sick. She was still feverish. I couldn't figure out what was wrong. I tested her for HIV and my heart was in my throat, you know, as it came back negative. And finally, I treated her for TB and she got better. And because of the nature of the treatment, She needed to stay in the hospital for the whole time, so I got to see her walk. I got to see her talk. And at one point, I was considering, before we found someone to care for her, that if no one would, I asked my field coordinator, this is a hypothetical case, but if someone wanted to adopt a kid that they were treating with, do you think it's possible? And she said, I don't think it's a good idea. And so I didn't. Mm. But,
You wanted to take her home.
Yeah, I just felt that their problems were mine. And if, every day, this whole book in many ways is about her. When the war finally came to that place, my first thoughts were like, did I do the right thing? And if I could think of one great outcome from this whole thing, I would love to be able to know what happened to her, where she is.
And when you got back to Canada from Sudan, your heart was pretty heavy. You write in your book that it was hard coming home. You said that your home never fit you properly again. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little about that?
My first thought when I arrived from Abyei and I was on the bus going to Geneva for my debriefing was, wow, look at all this food. It's all food. It's a convenience store and then a bakery and then a restaurant. We've eliminated every natural conflict in our life, and so now we've sorted it out. So now we're left with this conflict of choice. So now that's how we get, that friction with the real world. And so that poor fit can kind of translate to, you feel a distance from your friends, not like your distance from the real world, but their distance from the real world. How can they not know? And so that kind of gradually simmers its way down from a boil to, like a simmer. But ultimately, I think in the end, when you engage in this kind of work, what you wonder is, how do you give yourself permission to disengage? When do you say stop? So you wonder if you ever go back to being the person you were, not because of some, psychological trauma or anything like that, just because you've seen the truth, you've seen the world.
James Moskalic is an assistant professor at the University of Toronto, where he practices emergency medicine. He's currently working with the Addis Ababa University to develop a training program for Ethiopia's first ER physicians. To find out more about James's book, 6 Months in Sudan, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. Most aid organizations, like Doctors Without Borders, hope that at some point in the future, their services won't be needed, that someday there will be enough local doctors and nurses to take over their work. Reporter Rochelle Borlase met a young girl in Sierra Leone with big dreams of becoming a doctor, but the obstacles in her way seemed insurmountable. Agnes was working as a stick seller, carrying long, thin tree trunks on her head to sell at the market. Rochelle Borlase sent us this reporter's notebook.
I saw a lot of young girls from Kamoria Village do the work of women. They were able to lift the same heavy loads of tree trunks on their heads and walk the same distances. They felt the same sense of familial duty to feed their families. 12-year-old Agnes Kanu was one of them.
Every day I come again. And they give me mama.
When I get money, I give it to my mother, she told me. She uses it to help with her small business. She sells cassava cakes. She doesn't force me to do this. Agnes was the only member of her family who sold sticks. Some of her siblings were too young, and the boys weren't expected to do the work. Agnes was responsible for making the money to buy rice for her family of 9. But unlike all of the other girls from Kamoria, Agnes Kanu also had personal reasons for wanting to be a stick seller. When I met her, she'd just finished grade 4 and was hoping to start grade 5 when classes resumed. Her mother sometimes let her keep a bit of her earnings to pay for school, and so she was trying to raise the $2 tuition fee along with enough money to buy a new pair of shoes. Agnes told me she didn't plan on being a stick seller forever.
I make doctor. Doctor.
I want to be a doctor, she told me. In the months that followed, I often checked in on Agnes Kanu at the stick seller's market in McKinney. She was always stoic, whether she'd had a good day or not.
Ah, no sell it. I forgot.
I haven't sold any yet, she said.
Tomorrow I come back, I can sell.
But tomorrow I will try to sell them again. Most of the time she didn't make a sale, but still she was there day after day. On my last visit to Camoria Village before leaving Sierra Leone, I went to Agnes's home to say goodbye. I didn't think she'd be there because the group of stick sellers hadn't returned from the market that day. I was right. Agnes wasn't home. But this time, her mother proudly reported I could find her in school. In 2 months, Agnes managed to save enough money for tuition and a new pair of flip-flops while still helping to feed her family. Somehow, in this tiny and isolated village of northern Sierra Leone, Agnes Kanu knew her only shot at improving her life was by going to school. If I ever return to Sierra Leone, I'll check on Agnes Kanu to see if she's become a doctor.
That was reporter Rachelle Borlase from Sierra Leone.
Hi, I'm Ishma Fundikwa, the global music guide for the World Vision Report. Today we are off to Rwanda, a small country in Central Africa, where Cecile Kairebwa has done a lot to take the traditional music of her country to a wider audience. From the CD Rwanda, here is Cecile and a song called Tarihinda. That was Tarihinda by Cecile Kairebwa. Later in the show, another Rwandan star who's made good will be talking with Peggy Waymire. Stay tuned for more with Enric Sifa ahead on the World Vision Report.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. A new report from the World Health Organization says women are living 6 to 8 years longer than men. In many societies, widowed women are cared for by their families and communities. But that's not the case in some parts of India, where widows are seen as a curse. They're shunned, discarded by family and friends. So many of them head to the northern city of Vrindavan to beg on the streets. Reporter Will Everett visited the city of widows and filed this story.
It's the monsoon season, and in the city of Vrindavan, 100 miles south of Delhi, water rushes through the streets in a continuous brown stream. Beggars hunker in doorways and alleyways to escape the downpour. A surprising number of them are women, most of them hunchbacked and old. Until a few months ago, 90-year-old Tulsi was one of them.
I came to Vrindavan 15 years ago. My son and daughter wouldn't take care of me. I had to live on the streets as a beggar. I sent messages to my son asking for help, but he refused.
Most widows in India are cared for by their children or in-laws, but in some parts of the country, widows are expelled from the house because they're seen as a curse, someone who might bring bad luck on the family. Other widows feel it's their duty to leave and save the family from further misfortune. In some parts of the country, property is transferred through the mother. When she becomes a widow, there's often pressure to get her out of the house so the children can collect the inheritance. In any event, many of these widows come to Vrindavan, the traditional birthplace of Krishna, the supreme deity in Hindu belief.
There is a kind of a feeling in the mind itself which says, once you are widowed, you are married to Lord Krishna.
Dr. Mohini Giri runs the Guild of Service, an organization that works for the welfare of widows in India.
And this is the feeling with which these widows come to Vrindavan, that they have given up everything now. It's better to come to a place like Vrindavan, where there are other women also who are like you, and in togetherness they find courage.
Over the centuries, the city of widows became the city of beggars. 10 years ago, Dr. Giri built a shelter that would house 100 or so displaced widows. but the building was old and not nearly big enough. Last year, that changed. In a spacious kitchen a few miles outside of Vrindavan, a half dozen old women scurry around washing dishes after the evening meal. This is Madam, or Mother's Home, a kind of commune for the discarded and unwanted. The Guild of Service constructed this clean, modern shelter with mostly private donations. It can house up to 500 widows. Most of them have come from nearby Vrindavan. But as word has gotten around, widows have started coming from elsewhere in the country. The women share household duties, work in the vegetable garden, and teach each other skills such as sewing and crafts. Today, an auto rickshaw, a three-wheeled cart powered by a motorcycle engine, brings five new widows to Madam. They're all women in their 70s and 80s. Their ragged white saris are traditional dress for widowed beggars, a symbol of their invisibility. A Madam worker found them begging in Vrindavan and talked them into coming here. The women seem wary and disoriented as they're escorted into the building carrying their belongings in ragged bundles. They're greeted by Gita, who was herself recently widowed. The 45-year-old could have stayed with her in-laws, but she chose to give the rest of her life in service to other widows.
I wasn't forced to come here. I came willingly. When the older women who are handicapped want food or water, I bring it from the kitchen. I want to see smiles on all their old faces.
Once the monsoon season is over, those who are able to work will help in the garden. Right now, the garden is underwater, but by summer, Madam will be raising all of its own vegetables. For now, the widows pass the time reading the Hindu scriptures or chatting. One woman stares out her open window as she plays a shavi, a flute used in the worship of Krishna. During a break in the rains, wild peacocks gather atop the walls of Madam as the widows hang their saris out to dry. Tulsi, the 90-year-old widow who was a beggar for 15 years, smiles as she watches them parading back and forth on the wall. She says she hasn't felt this happy in a long time.
I feel like I'm getting all the happiness I lost for the past 15 years. I have a dry place to sleep and food every day. What more do I need at my age?
For the World Vision Report, I'm Will Everett in India.
There's a compelling photo gallery of the widows in the shelter. You can see it at worldvisionreport.org. Enric Sifa hasn't hit the big time in the U.S. yet, but he's a household name in Rwanda. That's where he was born. In 1994, Enric was a child and blissfully unaware of the catastrophe that was about to undo his life.
The genocide happened in 94 when I was 5 to 6 years old. And that's where my dad and most of my family died there. And I went to hide in the jungle for all the time genocide was happening. And after the genocide, I thought I was only one left. And then when I went to the camp where people would go to get food, then I found my mom there. So my mom also was survived.
But the joy of that reunion was short-lived. In the aftermath of the genocide, Enric's mother was murdered by her neighbors. That left Enric alone, an orphan among thousands of others who survived the ethnic killings. He ended up living on the streets. The memory of his mother and her dying words kept him going.
My mom always wanted me to be a singer, and she always tell me that I should keep doing it. I should keep singing because I saw my mom when my mama was dying. She was actually bleeding, you know, and she couldn't say a lot of words to me, but she was telling me to be careful with life, and nurse was telling me to keep singing and stuff like that. She was encouraging me that I'm going to be fine in life, yeah.
And how long, Enric, did you live on the streets by yourself with nobody that you knew?
6 years.
How did you survive?
Well, surviving was really hard. You know, you could get a meal once in a while, but for me, I started playing, do you know marbles?
Marbles in the street? You played with marbles?
Yes, so on the street, we used to play marbles for money as something like street gambling. And then if I ran out of money, then I could do go like on the street and see people walking by having their luggage. And then I could ask them if I could help them to carry their luggage on my head so that then they can give me money.
And that's how you survived for
yes.
6 years like that. Did anybody know who you were or what had happened to you?
Well, when you get on the streets like that, some people, they actually pretended that they never knew me because I was a street kid. And so it was kind of weird and sad.
How did you emotionally cope with that, being homeless and alone at such a young age?
Well, my mom was a singer before she died, and I used to sing a lot every night. And so I used to sing my mom's songs a lot when I was in the street. Sinje mami, sinje wavite, nurukundo wanze nakuze. Also, the other kids on the street also, they used to hang out with me. I was kind of popular on the street because whenever they were like bored or afraid or anything, they could come and sit next to me because I was always like harmonizing or singing my mom's songs. So it was, you know, bad life. But by then, I was like, well, I can, you know, just sit here and sing it to myself and do some dancing, and you know, so. And I knew that one day I would grow up and be a singer.
You did?
Yeah.
What was it in you that had the hope to keep going, that one day you'd be a singer and it wouldn't always be like this?
I don't know. It was because whatever I did, like, the friends on the street, they like appreciated it, you know, kind of encouraging me. And they were telling me, oh, dude, you know, you are good. Oh, dude, you are gonna be a singer, you know. And then when I became like 11, I started to go to clubs, to nightclubs, you know. I would like jump the fence and then find myself inside the club. Then go there and shake my hips and dance, you know.
So you went to the nightclubs for the music and dancing?
Yes, because I wanted something to cheer me up. I didn't have any money to pay for the fee, and I didn't have any money to buy any drinks there, but I would just only go there so that I can dance, you know. So, yeah.
Sounds like you really lived, that singing and dancing kept your spirits up.
Yeah, it got my spirit up, and, you know, because my mom was a singer too. And so I grew up in that kind of family. So when I got on the street, I was sad, really, really sad for a long time. Yeah.
You mentioned that one of the things that comforted you as a very young boy on the streets without your parents was remembering the songs your mother sang.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of songs did she sing, and what did you used to sing to yourself at night as a little boy?
There was like some of the like popular Kinyarwanda songs, or the songs like, do you want me to do like a small part?
Yeah, can you sing a part for us? That would be great.
Naya kanigi kanje mama yandaja shaje sinza okazi miriye ndakabaroga navuye wacu nkanigirije niziwe nabandi barabivuga noneho kazi miriye sinamenye naya kanigi kanje niba ntakabonye nziyahura naya kanigi. Yeah, something like that.
Well, what a beautiful song. And you remembered. What are the words in English? Can you translate for us?
It says that I just lost my precious necklace. It just disappeared. I don't know where it went. I just lost my necklace. If I don't get my necklace, I probably will die. I just need my necklace back.
Now, why did you love that song so much? Why was that a comfort to you?
I love the melody, and also I love the lyrics, because for me, the necklace, to me, the precious necklace was my mom, because my mom was a hero to me. I just translated the necklace actually as my mom, because I don't have any hope for my life without my necklace, without my mom.
That's very powerful. Now, you used music, you hung onto music, going first, you said, to these nightclubs. I'm wondering, how did you get regularly involved in music?
I went to a dancing club like how I used to go to, and they beat me up because I was young. And then it was Saturday night. The following day on Sunday, I just decided to go to a church by myself. And when I went to church, I loved the music in the church. It was free, where I didn't have to pay, and people would not beat me up in the church. Then I got off the street because people in the church invited me to live with them.
Is there another song on your recent album that comes from that period, something you wrote about that period in your life that we might be able to hear?
Yes, A Beautiful Woman.
She was a beautiful woman. She was a beautiful woman.
Enric, when did you write that song?
I think I was 13.
Tell me about that song, A Beautiful Woman. I'm guessing that you're singing about your mother.
Yes, I'm singing about my mom. So I was saying that she was a beautiful woman, and I never know whether I will see my mom again. But what I believe, there is a place for innocent people. My mom is there. Another part said, the last word she said was, move forward, move forward, move forward, my son.
And you certainly have moved forward.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a song you wrote early on. And yeah. You continued to sing in Rwanda, but you ended up here in the United States. How did you come to live here in the United States, where I understand you're currently enrolled in high school as a 22-year-old?
Yeah, I won a nationwide music competition, which is like American Idol. And then I became like known in my country a lot, you know, in magazine, every day, and TV, radio station. And, you know, I got number one on Rwandan charts. And then I started touring also in the United States for music tours, helping African New Life Ministry to raise sponsorship and funds, because I loved what they were doing and I always wanted to help other kids in Africa too. Then after I was a singer, then I decided to go back to school for a while so that I can focus on my schooling. So now I live here with the host family and they go to high school.
Well, how do you like high school?
It's fun.
And you're still writing music and you still go back to Rwanda and perform?
Yes, 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 still writing music. And I still perform here in the United States too.
You've become a real superstar in Rwanda. I hear that about 70,000 people turned out for one of your last concerts and that you're practically
yes.
mobbed on the streets. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's beautiful. You know, I think it's a part of my dreams. My dream is to be a music known. Then it gave me encouragement that that I can actually do it even in the worldwide.
You're doing exactly what your mother dreamed for you.
Yes, 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 yeah. So I think my life is so much better now, and I'm singing always and going around the world singing, so I enjoy it.
Enric, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your story with us, and we wish you the very best with your music and your finishing up your high school career.
Thank you so much.
Hey, yeah. Hey, yeah. Hey, yeah. Hey, yeah. Hey, yeah.
Henrik Sifa is a musician from Rwanda. Now he lives just outside Portland, Oregon. We'll go out today on some music from Henrik's latest CD called My Love. Our show is on the web. You can download a podcast there if you want to take us with you. The address, worldvisionreport.org. You can follow us on Twitter, and you can become a fan of the World Vision Report on Facebook, where every Friday there's a sneak preview of our upcoming show. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.